You're listening to the 10 Bagger Podcast, presented by The Daily Gold. Join us as we uncover tomorrow's 10 baggers today. And now here's your host, Jordan Royburn.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of the 10 Bagger Podcast. I know it's been a while since I did my last episode, but I have a guest for you today I think you're really going to like. He's Rick Rule. And Rick, thank you so much for coming on today. And I'm not going to introduce you because everybody already knows who you are, so I don't want to waste time doing that. But why don't you could tell the audience, I think you've stepped back from your main job. Tell the audience what you're up to these days.
Well, it's a pleasure to be on with you, first of all. I have, as you suggest, formally retired. That doesn't mean I stopped working. I'm working sort of 1,800 hours a year. But what I've done is stepped away from any regulated capacity. So I'm no longer an employee or an officer of Sprott Inc., as an example. I remain their largest shareholder. I remain on the board of directors. But I've given up all of my securities licenses. So I'm not doing any regulated activities, which I must say is a joy. I've also given up any administrative responsibility. I used to have a couple hundred employees who directly or indirectly reported to me. Now I have one, and I report to her. So in retirement, I'm building a business called Rule Investment Media with no idea how I'm going to monetize it. I'm investing my own money, investing and speculating. And I'm celebrating turning 69 by backing the old management team that I backed, at EverBank in starting a brand new online bank. The last one was a great adventure. We took it from zero to $28 billion in AUM before selling it to TIA Cref. It was a 30 bagger for the original investors. So as I say, I'm celebrating turning 69 by starting a new bank.
Well, that's great. I want to talk to you about 10 baggers. I guess my first question would be, can you remember the first 10 bagger that you had?
To be honest with you, I cannot. It would have been in the early part of the decade of the 70s. I had the good fortune to become involved in the natural resources business in the early part of the decade. I had the better fortune to be attending the University of British Columbia, and Vancouver was the epicenter of the speculative part of that resource boom. I can't remember my first 10 bagger, to be honest with you, but there were several of them that decade, which I enjoyed really not knowing what I was doing. It was an extremely benign, at least the beginning of that decade, was an extremely benign period to be a natural resource investor because nobody much cared. You didn't have much competition. Towards the end of the decade, of course, when the bull market was underway and everybody was accustomed to believing that they could obtain 10 baggers easily, the market punished them, but that's a different story.
I know in the past you've talked about how you confused a bull market with brains. I mean, the 10 baggers that you had, did they remain 10 baggers for you, or did they go back to being like one or two baggers?
I was pretty good about harvesting gains, first of all, Jordan. But the other thing that I was good at as a young man, and believe me, I did confuse a bull market with brains. But I had the good fortune in the early part of the decade of the 1970s to run across some truly spectacular human beings, Chester Miller being one and Adolph Lundin being another. And a substantial part of the credit for the number of 10 baggers that I enjoyed was that I seemed to have an ability to pay less attention to the stories, particularly the popular stories, and pay more attention to the jockeys. In fact, as I look back, when I look at where my 10 baggers have been concentrated, the most important consistent variable has been the quality of the people. I would venture to say that if in the last 40 years that I just invested with the people who I had been successful with in the first 10 years of my investing career, which is to say the Bob Quartermains, the Ross Beatties, the Clive Johnsons, the Adolph Lundins, the Lucas Lundins, the Robert Friedlands of the world, I would have enjoyed almost exactly the same number of 10 baggers, but I would have worked a quarter as hard and I would have suffered negligible losses, which isn't something that occurred. To me, the most important consistency is being a long-term and reliable supporter of tier one people. And I'm delighted to say that I've been able to do that for 40 years.
So with your investing now, I mean, based on your what you just said and your personal history, I mean, at least for the majority of your capital, are you keeping that within a select group of those people who have that track record who've made you money before?
I am doing that. You need to understand, Jordan, at age 69, having already made, without going into detail, more money than I can possibly spend in the remainder of my life, it's less necessary for me to achieve 10 baggers. I do it because it amuses me, and I like helping other people do it. The majority of my own wealth is invested in businesses, which will become perhaps 10 baggers over time, but not 10 baggers in the sense that you refer to. I am increasingly, if that can be possible, focusing my speculative investments around people who have been serially successful and have definitive competitive advantages. I'm less interested in whether those people are in the uranium space, which I love, or the oil and gas space, which I love, or the gold space, which I love, or some other commodity-specific area. I will say that in my experience, the best guide to commodity 10-baggers is the one that's most deeply out of favor. Because in order to enjoy a 10-bagger, the easiest way to achieve it is to front-run public opinion by 2 or 3 years. Get in cheap, see the sector go up, and when the sector has gone up and become popular, harvest your gains and move on. But a more important determinant than that is the people that you invest with and the terms that you invest under.
Okay, yeah, that's great. That's really helpful. So find great people, find what's out of favor. So, I mean, in your opinion, I mean, right now, which commodities do you think are most out of favor?
I think uranium is falling out of favor, which I love. I was early in the uranium trade, both in the 2000 bull market and in this one. Enjoyed more gains than I deserved in both cases. And in both cases, had the good sense to sell when the sector got overheated. I'm delighted with the setup in uranium stocks. The uranium price in the last 3 years has more than doubled. The time frame until the price of uranium goes to the incentive cost has shortened substantially. The catalysts in the market, which include the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust tightening up the spot market, but more importantly, the increasing pace of Japanese restarts is upon us, while at the same time, the equity index has fallen by 45% in 6 months. So speculating in the inevitable has become half as expensive, even as the time frame has tightened up. To make things better, if you're really searching for 10 baggers, you want to participate in the uranium space around private placements. And many of the uranium juniors played chicken with capital markets, which is to say they thought that the stocks would get more expensive and their cost of capital would go down. And they deferred fundraising, and they're going to need to raise money in 2022. So the ability to participate in high-quality projects on a private placement basis, where you get a warrant to go along with your share, I think will be as good in 2022 as it was in 2019, which was in fact a banner year. So I think that circumstance is very much in place. I'm attracted too, Jordan, to the precious metals space. I really truly believe that the wind is in the sails of precious metals. And yet the precious metals price has been stagnant and the price of precious metals equities has been falling. And I, for one, believe it's more likely than not that we see sharply higher rather than higher precious metals prices. I think, too, that precious metals speculators are much more narrative oriented, which means that people who are in search of 10 baggers look at the 1,500 or 2,000 precious metals mining companies, ostensibly mining companies, that litter the investment landscape, and they aren't very discriminatory. When one looks at 10 baggers in junior mining, one needs to understand that if you merged every company in the sector into one company and called it Junior Explorco, that company would lose between $2 billion and $5 billion a year, which is to say that the junior resource sector taken as a whole is valueless. How much should you pay for a business that loses $2 billion a year? Obviously, the answer is nothing. That truth, though, belies a much more useful truth, which is to say that 5% of the listings, perhaps 100 companies out of a 2,000 company data set, deliver so much value that they add legitimacy and sometimes even luster to a sector that loses between $2 and $5 billion a year. So stock selection is critical. Mercifully, because the precious metals are, from a broad standpoint, out of favor, you can buy that sort of 100 or 150 company data set at the same multiple that you would pay for the rest of the companies in the sector, which is to say the lame, the halt, and the blind. This is, I think, an extraordinary period, 2022, to pay attention on a discriminating basis to private placements in sort of sub 250 million market cap precious metals exploration and junior production companies.
Okay, so you're talking about exploration, but one question I have for you is, is it only exploration for you, or do you think it's possible to find 10 baggers that are in junior producers or developers are going to build the mine, or is it mostly exploration where the best opportunity is? Give me some color on that.
I think it's absolutely possible to find 10 baggers among junior producers or in particular among the developers. But your audience needs to understand that in order to do that, you need to be prepared to hold the company for 5 years. You need the power of compounding. Too many people, when they look at 10 baggers, expect immediate gratification. When I look back at the 10 baggers in my career, and I've done fairly exhaustive studies on what I did right and what I did wrong, what I found was that the vast majority of my 10 baggers, 80% of them, required 4 or 5 years to give me 10 bagger status. And in addition, virtually everyone during virtually every 10 bagger, when I say one, virtually every 10 bagger that I enjoyed, fell by 30 or 40 or 50% in price during the period of time that I held it. So you have to have the knowledge that gives you the courage of your convictions to hold. One example would be that combines many of the themes that we've talked about here, Jordan, would be my backing Ross Beaty for decades. I knew him all the way back to the decade of the 70s. He, in fact, was at UBC the same time I was with him. And I believe now that I've participated in 14 Ross Beaty companies and experienced 12 10 baggers. So first of all, superior human being, Ross Beaty. Get in early when nobody cares, particularly in a bear market where Ross is involved in a commodity like silver in Pan American Silver when he started that, or copper, Lumina Copper, when he did that, when the commodity was deeply out of favor. Buy a big position, hang on for dear life through volatility, and be prepared to own the stock for 4 or 5 years. If I could bore your audience with a couple of war stories, Pan American Silver, I remember backing Ross Beaty in that after his Equinox success. And I believe that the first financing we did was at 50 cents with a 75 cent warrant. And if my memory serves me correctly, 6 years later, that stock was $45 bid. But twice during the period that I owned it between 50 cents and $45, the share price fell by 50% or more. A more exaggerated example, I think, is Lumina Copper, where I was after Ross Beaty, the first investor. We did it at a period of time when the copper price was, if my memory serves me well, 80 or 90 cents. It was deeply out of favor. The incentive price for new copper worldwide was a buck and a half, and the stuff was selling for 80 cents. meaning that the copper industry was producing stuff for a buck and a half, selling it for 80 cents, losing 60, 70 cents a pound and trying to make it up on volume. What that meant was that our competition for assets was very, very, very low. The entry price on an adjusted basis, if my memory serves me well, was about $2 a share. And 7 years later, when that company was broken up into seven companies, the exit price exceeded $162 a share. That necessitated backing a superior person during a period in time when no rational investor would be caught dead owning the copper business because it was in decline. And it also involves holding through two different periods where the stated market price of my investment fell by half.
So if you, assuming a person is going to hold for 5 years, then that mitigates the price risk when you're entering. In other words, what I mean is someone could buy something and then, you know, that it falls 30 or 50% and they're down that much. But if they're buying something that's out of favor and they're backing a really strong team, then over time, their odds of getting a 10 bagger are going to increase or be better, or at least that the entry price and the timing of that becomes less of a concern.
Absolutely. I think it's important to revisit your premise. Money is made, I think, on the dichotomy, on the delta between price and value. If you look at a stock that's selling for 50 cents, that's the information that everybody focuses on. You know, it's selling at 50 cents. Last week it was at 60 cents. Price information has no utility if you don't have an opinion as to value. If a stock is selling at 50 cents and you think it's worth a dollar, or if it's selling at 50 cents and you think a conjunction of de-risking actions will make it worth $2 a year from now, then that 50 cent piece of information, the price information, begins to have utility. The price information has no utility at all in the absence of an opinion as to value. Money is made on speculations, and speculations deliver 10 baggers through the simple process of answering unanswered questions, de-risking the value proposition. In exploration, it might be the extent of the surface anomaly, and you do that by sort of length and width of strike. The next de-risking is it superficial enrichment or does it extend to bedrock? So it may be that you run a series of trenches. The third question might be really the third dimension, so it requires a drill hole. The process of achieving a 10-bagger is really a process of answering a series of unanswered questions. And in search of a 10-bagger, if you get a no answer, which is to say that you have proven, unfortunately, that the thesis that causes you to believe that you may have a 10-bagger is untrue, you must sell the stock, including selling the stock at a loss.
Let's go back to war stories before we close, because I love those. Is there anything you passed on that turned out to be a 10-bagger, even far more than that? I mean, I guess one that irks you. I don't mean to scratch that itch, but that you can remember.
They don't irk me at all. I have the courage of my convictions because I'm disciplined. I've missed 50 10-baggers? And I don't mind it at all. I'm not one of those who's plagued by fear of missing out. Life has been very good to me. I've worked very hard. I've outcompeted people who are smarter than me and work harder than me and are richer than me simply because I'm so disciplined and I work hard enough. So I have generally bought too early. I've often sold too early. There have been occasions where I violated my own tenets around doing business with superior human beings, almost always with bad outcomes. I don't miss a thing. It is true that bad people can own good rocks and bad people can enjoy 10-baggers, but the probabilities are not on your side. The probabilities are that bad people do bad things with good rocks. and good people replace bad rocks with good rocks. So the circumstances where 10 baggers have been on offer and I have refused them have almost always had to do with bad people or me not being able to take advantage of serendipity. And I don't place much value on serendipity. I place no value either on hope. I would say that most people who are in search of 10 baggers are in search of 10 baggers that are psychologically easy. And that's usually an impossible thing to do. If people require price affirmation of their narrative, they're going to lose money. I remember 1999 and 2000 banging on lecterns telling people that the uranium price at $10 had to go to 30 or 40, and the uranium juniors as a class were going to go up fourfold or fivefold. Nobody cared at all. When the uranium price had gone from $10 to $50 or $60, which is to say where it didn't have to go up at all, people were begging me for uranium stocks. They required the price action to justify the narrative, and the value of the narrative had been depreciated by the fact that a whole bunch of the price action had always occurred. You follow what I'm saying? 10 baggers almost never occur in psychologically easy circumstances. I would say too that a disproportionate advantage I've had in enjoying 10 baggers has been my willingness to accept what other people have viewed as political risk. I've enjoyed 10 baggers in Syria, Sudan, Congo, Malawi, Botswana, Russia, Kazakhstan, Bolivia, Peru. You get it? There's a whole bunch of people in Vancouver who believe that the only place that they can invest is Ontario or British Columbia, which I think is a mistake. I personally believe, as an example, British Columbia to be a highly risky jurisdiction. And so I think that you need to accommodate a heightened understanding of political risk and a heightened understanding of the value of the narrative in the search for 10 baggers.
Okay, Rick, before I let you go, I guess one final question. Let's zero in. So which, as far as like the, let's think of like the best long-term value over the next 5 years. Tell me which commodity it is in right now, and also which is it in, the explorers, the developers, or the producers?
The category that will surprise people the most to the upside is the high-quality explorers, because nobody wants to be in them right now. What's worked for the last 20 years has been, you know, buying a property and answering a couple unanswered questions around the property. But Greenfields exploration has been out of favor for a very long time. And so Greenfields exploration is where people's expectation of success is the lowest, and hence where the rewards will be the highest. You're probably 2 years too early getting in, which is, of course, where I specialize. But I think that exploration has by far the most upside. In terms of jurisdiction, I would look to places that people hate. I would look to Central Africa and West Africa, and particularly I would look to the Tethyan Metallogenic Belt, that belt of rocks that goes from, depending on how you start it, Romania through Mongolia, through all those wonderful places known as the Stans, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Afghanistan, all the places that make you cringe because you don't have competition there. Areas that haven't been prospected by any mechanism more efficient than a pick and a mule are the places that are going to yield the huge, huge deposits going forward. In terms of commodities that I favor, ironically, despite the fact that it's moved a lot in price, I look at oil exploration, particularly offshore, particularly emerging markets oil exploration is being particularly fertile. I've enjoyed a lot of success there. And it's one of the few businesses where a company with a $60 or $70 million market cap can obtain a concession, de-risk the concession, preferably bring in a major, and discover a $5 or $6 billion deposit on a $10 million original exploration expense. Particularly, of course, if you do it in places that other people are afraid to go. This isn't something that you likely can cause to occur in Alberta or Texas. I think that the uranium juniors, particularly the uranium explorers, are all going to have to return to market for capital in the year 2022, and 10 baggers are easiest to achieve if you get a warrant. So participating in the high-quality uranium exploration juniors should be fertile ground. But for the first time probably in my career, the gold and silver stocks themselves on a net present value to enterprise value basis are surprisingly cheap, which means that the explorers in the precious metals sector are deeply, deeply out of favor. Don't count on finding an explorer with an inexperienced team, an experienced team or inexperienced team leading it in a jurisdiction that's in favor, say Nevada, British Columbia, or Ontario, necessarily having the ability to give you a 10-bagger. You need to take jurisdictional risk. You need to be looking for deposits that are at least 1 million ounces or hopefully 5 million ounces or the silver equivalent thereof, probably in places that you are less comfortable with. But I suspect that it will be more than a dozen of those circumstances that will unfold in the next 5 years. And I think 2022 and 2023 will be the time to get on board those with private placements, with generous warrants, because the companies will have trouble attracting capital.
Okay, Rick, thank you so much. You've provided, more than a handful of great nuggets here today. Before I let you go, can you tell our audience where they can go to follow you and Rule Investment Media?
Thank you for the opportunity, Jordan. And yes, please, I'll give them a special incentive. Any of your listeners, Jordan, who care to continue the discussion with me, I'll give them an incentive. If you go to ruleinvestmentmedia.com, you'll find a web form. If you enter your natural resource equities there, I'll rank them, at least if I know them. I'll rank them 1 to 10, 1 being best, 10 being worst. Further, if you are an accredited investor, it turns out I'm able to give cryptic advice to accredited investors because I'm no longer licensed. Specifically, I'm maintaining a list. It's free. And every time I invest in a private placement, I will give notification to the people on the list what placements I'm participating in. There's no guarantee that because I get in, you get in, but it costs you nothing. So in the question and comment section at ruleinvestmentmedia.com, mention placements. Two, I'm very, very attracted to the uranium space, and so I'm hosting an online boot camp March 19th, 6-hour online boot camp, an investors and speculators masterclass in uranium, $99. If you care about information there at Rule Investment Media, mention boot camp. Finally, if you are a U.S. or Canadian person who is unhappy with your current bank, and I think that extends to every investor or speculator in the United States and Canada, and you care about my new bank, in the question and comment section at Rule Investment Media, mention bank, and I'll keep you on the line so that you can learn how to be a customer of Battle Bank, which I hope will receive its charter in June or July of this coming year.
Okay, great. Thanks for all that, Rick. And thanks again for coming on today. I really appreciate it. And I hope our listeners take you up on your offers there.
Thank you. I look forward to being of use to everybody.
Thank you for listening to the 10 Bagger Podcast, presented by The Daily Gold. For premium coverage of precious metals and the best junior mining companies, visit thedailygold.com/premium.